Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
All right, welcome everyone to LSE for today's event, Wired to Save the Planet, Rethinking Energy in an Electrified World. The event forms part of the LSE Festival, titled How to Save the Planet, which is running from Monday, 15th June, continuing until Saturday, 20th June, with a series of events exploring what we can be doing to save the Earth, its people, and the environment from existential threats, including the climate crisis, conflict, and artificial intelligence. My name is Shefali Khanna, and I'm an LSE Fellow in Energy Economics and Policy in the Department of Geography and Environment at LSE. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome our speakers, Tim Heal, Spencer Dale, Teresa Chambers, and Min Cha, to both our online audience and the audience here in the room. I'll now briefly introduce our speakers. Tim Heal sits on the leadership team of Octopus Energy Group and is responsible for global strategy, corporate development, and international expansion. For 4 years, he led revenue growth for Kraken, delivering enterprise software deals totaling 70 million utility customer relationships. Since 2017, Tim's team has executed more than 40 strategic deals, including acquisitions of retail energy businesses, energy startups, and technology platforms. Next, we have Spencer Dale, who's a professor in practice in the Global School of Sustainability at LSE. Spencer was previously chief economist at the Bank of England, including during the financial crisis. And he's been a trusted advisor and counselor for a range of individuals and institutions, including the Federal Reserve Board. Teresa Chambers is a senior analyst and public sector leader currently working in the UK government's Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, where she leads on power sector analysis. Her team applies analytical, economic, and systems thinking approaches to some of the most complex challenges facing the energy system today. And finally, we have Min Cha, who is an LSE Fellow in Energy Economics and Policy in the Department of Geography and Environment. In her research, Min draws on her interdisciplinary background to examine topics such as renewable energy policy, electricity markets, the adoption of clean energy technologies, and energy consumption behavior. So that's our panel. And today we'll be exploring the future of energy systems in the transition to net zero. We all know electricity demand is continuing to rise sharply, driven by the electrification of buildings, transport, and industry, as well as the explosive growth of AI and data centers. At the same time, we're striving to decarbonize the power system. And so the question we'll be asking the panel is, how can we ensure that energy remains clean, reliable, and affordable? Our panel of experts will discuss the opportunities, challenges, and solutions that could shape the energy system of tomorrow. As part of the discussion, we'll be exploring how digitalization, renewable energy, and evolving market structures are transforming the way we generate, trade, and consume energy. Together, we'll ask, what does it take to build a truly sustainable and intelligent energy system, and who gets to design it? So, in terms of the format for today's event, each speaker will be delivering five-minute opening statements on the topic. We'll then move to a moderated discussion between the chair and the speakers for about 10 minutes. As usual, there will then be a chance for you to put your questions to our speakers. For our online audience, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature. Please include your name and affiliation. And for those of you here in the room, I'll let you know when we open the floor for questions. Please raise your hand and wait for one of the stewards with the roving microphones to get to you. Again, please let us know your name and affiliation before stating your question. I'll try to get a range of questions from our online audience and the audience here in the room. For social media users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. I'd ask you to please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. With that, I'm going to turn now to our panel for their opening statements on the topic. Tim, we'll begin with you.
Thanks very much, Shefali. Hello, everyone. Good evening. It's very nice to see you all here. So I'm delighted to be the first to thank you for giving up some time to come and be involved in this important topic. You know, whatever you do in your personal life, in your careers, I hope you do work on saving the planet. It's a pretty important agenda. And it's how I got involved with Octopus Energy. So I was, before I was at Octopus, I was a management consultant, which I did for 7 years across telco and energy. And what drew me into the energy sector was exactly this this sort of mission, which is we need to do something about this. And the more of us who are engaged in this problem and caring about it, wherever we touch it in our lives or our careers, the better. And I sort of truly believe in that power of kind of collective action, as it were. So if you live in the UK, you've probably heard of us, and certainly if you are spending time in London, we, you know, like to cover the city with sort of purple advertisements wherever we can. We are the largest energy supplier in the UK with 8 million household customers, but we also operate across another 7 countries in other retail energy markets. So in the 4 largest European energy markets of Germany, France, Spain, and Italy, but also in Japan, New Zealand, and Texas, where we have a further 4 million household customers. And we do lots of other things as well. So we, you know, we install solar panels and heat pumps, and we lease electric vehicles, and we install EV chargers, and we have a whole bunch of technology that's designed to help integrate electric demand, electrified demand, into the energy system alongside renewables. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that's so important. Energy is a, and has been, I think, for as long as we've had energy systems, and that's obviously been quite a long time, it's really been about infrastructure, really. It's been about building large things, whether they were fossil fuel things or whether they were electricity generating things. It's been about large amounts of kind of metal and wires. And, you know, if we think about the sort of modern energy system, and that infrastructure mindset dominates the way we operate our energy systems, the way we think about investing in them, for example, and building them out. And that has been really, you know, a model that's worked very well for building out those energy systems, for building the energy system, which is the largest man-made structure on the planet and which powers our society. But the problem is, of course, that, you know, as we all know, climate change is an existential threat to humanity. And the energy system we have today is going to kill the planet if we don't change it. And so we've now got this very difficult job. How do we kind of get out of the model we're in and into something else? And what we believe at Octopus is that this is really about putting the individual back in the mix here. We talk about the consumer, you know, consumer meaning customer. You can sort of call it whatever you like, but, you know, us individually. And if we can't find a way of returning the benefits of the energy transition, of the move to renewable energy, of electrification to customers, then as a mission, it won't succeed. It has to work for people. It can't just put sort of money in the pockets of other businesses. Because if we can get it to work for people, then we will get adoption, then we will get demand, then people will start to vote with their wallets, actually. And if you look at economic transitions, they often go very quickly when they are demand-led rather than being supply-led. So this is the difference between being at the supply side of the energy system, pushing stuff into it and hoping people will buy it, versus being at the demand side, making sure that people do buy it, working on the product or the proposition, or and then driving that sort of stimulus back up the supply chain. And so at Octopus, we work very, very hard on customer service. You know, it's what we're known for. We top the customer service charts. Our NPS is head and shoulders above all the rest of the companies that we compete with. Wherever we go, we try to do this because it is the absolute bedrock of a consumerized energy transition. If your consumers or your customers don't trust you, that you are you're competent or that you have good intentions, then they won't want to engage with you on a broader story around that transition. Whereas if they do, they will. And that's what we find at Octopus. Our customers want to engage with us around the various products and services we offer because we trust that we're actually trying to do the right thing by them. So that's the kind of first key ingredient, which is we have to deliver a good core product and build trust with customers. The second thing is, as I said, energy has been a sort of world of infrastructure, now, as you in a sort of inevitable consequence of building more intermittent generation, renewables and solar, is that we can't control that supply of energy like we used to. So when you're dealing with fossil fuels, it's very easy. You turn them on and off, you burn stuff whenever you want electricity. You know, when everyone's watching TV in the evening and cooking dinner and all the rest of it, you burn more stuff. Easy. In a world of wind and solar, hydro, you know, whatever, other sources of it, it's harder. And so logically, therefore, what you must do is you must control demand and you must store electricity. There's no other way. If you can't control one side of the system, you have to control the other side of the system. And in order to do that, we need the buy-in from our customers, whether they're consumers or businesses. We need to make it work for them. And so at Octopus, this is the problem that we work very hard on. And the term in the energy industry is flexibility, and we work very hard on consumer flexibility. And this is essentially using electricity when it's abundant, when it's available in the system, which is often, although not always, when there's lots of renewables on the system itself. The final thing I'll say, just as an opening point, is if we want to drive a consumerized energy transition and a demand-led transition, we have to think really, really hard about cost. And one of the things that's getting in the way at the moment is energy is too expensive. Now, I think, Shefali, you mentioned, you know, we're seeing demand sort of go up. Actually, the picture is more complex than that. It's growing in some areas, certainly, you know, connected to GDP growth, it's growing. But actually, in developed economies, what we're seeing is actually the opposite. We're seeing demand flat or declining. And so we've got this big problem at the moment because we are trying to invest in the system to get us to where we need to be in terms of decarbonisation. But in doing that, we're making the units of the thing we're selling more expensive, and that is destroying demand, whether at the household level or the business level. It's stopping people from using electricity. It's just a natural economic effect. And so what we need to do now, and this is very, very hard, and you know, the existential problem I think the system is engaged with is how do we actually get that cost, if not down, to flatten off or at least be at a level where we can still drive the growth of electrification. And so, you know, as a company, this is what we're working on in, you know, wherever we can, but also from a regulatory and a policy perspective, it's also what we're kind of very focused on as well. So I'll stop there because that was sort of quite a lot, but hopefully that's a helpful opener.
Thanks very much, Tim. I think what comes through quite clearly is how much hinges on getting consumers to become active grid participants and the role of sort of technology in enabling that as well. Spencer, we'll turn to you next.
Thank you. This is my first experience of the LSE Festival. As Shefali said, I joined the Global School of Sustainability about 3 months ago, so I now feel like I'm playing at home, which is really, really nice. I thought Tim's point about transitions being demand-led and being focused with people is fantastic. Unfortunately, I sit in an office just around the corner thinking about global trends, and I can't compete with Octopus. So let me do just a couple of observations about sort of how the global energy system is electrifying and some of the issues there. And I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to say a couple of observations, then I'm going to, by final bit, I want to ask a question. And I may ask a question both to the panel, but also of the audience as well, in terms of crowdsourcing. So as Shefali said, the energy system is electrifying. So if you look back in over the last 10 years, power demand at a global level has grown twice as fast as the rest of energy demand. And so as a result of which, more and more of our energy is electrifying. In sort of, you look at sort of consensus estimates and projections for the next 10 years, that's like to accelerate even more. So power demand is like to grow at 3 or 4 times the rate of overall energy demand. So the IEA, the International Energy Agency, talk about this as the age of electrification of what's going on. Just a couple of points about that sort of age of electrification. One, the vast majority of that growth in electricity demand is happening in emerging markets and developing economies. In the sort of scenarios I used to play with, 75-80% is not happening within the advanced developed world. It's all happening to a very large extent in terms of developing economies and emerging markets. That really matters because when you sit here, you can often get obsessed about what's happening at home. So you pick up the paper and you hear about the sort of queues for interconnections in Europe, or you hear about people wringing their hands about will there be enough energy to power data centres in America. But in terms of what really is going to drive the electrification agenda, it's not what's happening in Europe. the surrounding error. It's not what's happening in America. It's what's happening in those developing economies and those emerging markets. So when thinking about what barriers do we need to overcome, where do we need to put our focus of energy, it's there. It's not in the advanced world. Secondly, despite this strong growth, electricity still only provides a relatively small share of the energy we consume. So typically, we think about this as the share of energy, or electricity, as a share of the energy we consume at the point we actually use that energy. So we, in sort of economic speak, we talk about this as total final consumption, energy at the point you use it. So as a point where you plug your kettle in or turn your oven on. And today, as measured in that way, electricity only accounts around 20% of the energy we use at that final point of use. If you look at the trends and see where that's going to get, where will that take us? That will get somewhere sort of between the mid to high 20s by 2035. So still a relatively small share. What's interesting as part of the lead up to this, the COP at the end of this year in Turkey, which is co-hosted with Australia. I don't know quite how Australia and Turkey ended up co-hosting. They're pushing quite hard an agenda of 35 by 35. And what that 35 by 35 means, they want to try and get a share of 35% electricity in total final consumption by 2035. Now, the current trends are to the sort of mid to late 20s, so that's an enormous stretch agenda, but it's a sort of thing that I think there will be a lot of momentum building up this year in the lead up to this year's COP, so that would be something to follow. Just as an aside, for if there's any sort of real energy nerds here or are thinking deeply about this as a student, there's a really nice piece by somebody called Michael Liebrich last week that essentially said, I really like the idea of electrification, but you shouldn't do it in terms of total final energy consumption because of the problem that total final energy consumption, and the idea here is when you use electricity, it's far more efficient the way you use it than if you're using a fossil fuel. So if you put petrol into your car, a vast majority of that energy will be wasted. Whereas if you put electricity into an electric car, far more of that is useful energy. And Michael has a really interesting piece about the importance of useful energy rather than measured energy. And so if you want to get into sort of that thing, that's it's sort of, I think it sounds a bit nerdy, but I think it's very important when we're thinking about electrification. So they have my two observations. And now's my question, which is a genuine question because I'm worrying about it and thinking about it, and I thought this was a good place to share my worries and concerns. So the backdrop here is we're living in a world now which I think because of the conflict we're seeing at the moment, which followed fast on the heels of the energy crisis in Ukraine, where energy security has become sort of a critical part of what politicians' energy systems need to deliver. So politicians highly focused on energy security. And I'm trying to think about how does that sit with a world of increasing electrification? So if you look at the scenarios we think about, how would the world get to net zero? It's exactly the story that Tim was telling. In those worlds where the world the energy system can get to net zero, energy will often provide electricity will often provide 50 or 60% of the energy that our energy systems will use. So one single energy vector providing 50 or 60% of our energy. We don't have any single energy vector anywhere close to that today. Now there's some parts of electricity which are intrinsically good for an energy security story. So most of that energy, often, especially in those net zero world, will be produced domestically in terms of wind and solar, potentially nuclear in some parts of the world. So you're not subject to the vagaries of geopolitical problems and the weaponizing of energy in the same way. Another part is you can make electricity with many different types of energy sources. And so you're not dependent on one single source. You've got many different types of energy sources. So that's the good news. The bad news is energy is obviously, electricity is delivered by grids, which are pretty fragile beasts, and they're quite vulnerable to physical attacks. They're quite vulnerable to cyber attacks. The other problem with energy is it's quite expensive to store. When I think the history is written of the current crisis, and we say, why did all the economists get it wrong? Why did they see energy was, oil prices were going to go up to $150 or $200, and they stayed at $100? I think a big part of that story was because we had huge reserves of oil that we could fall back on. And so after the last major oil price shock in 73, the Arab oil embargo, essentially all the major oil-consuming countries of the world agreed to store 3 months worth of oil. So 3 months worth of oil consumption, they stored it. I don't think any country in the world has 3 hours of power. So my question is, and so this now starts, well, can I think about electrification in the world of energy security? Or to put this question more concretely, this is the question to the other panel or to you, is what things should we be doing now as we electrify the energy system? So then as our energy systems become more and more electrified, we can be confident that's in a way which is consistent with a secure energy system, because there's challenges to it. And if we don't embrace those challenges until we get to a highly electrified energy system, it would be too late. So what things should we be doing now and thinking about now to ensure that security, sort of energy security and electrification can go hand in hand?
Thanks a lot, Spencer, for that very helpful global macro picture. And I'm sure a lot of people in the audience will be thinking about the question you posed. We'll move next to Teresa.
Yeah, careering back to the UK. But that was really, really helpful context, actually. And you stole a couple of things I was going to say. So I'm amazed, actually. One of the things I love about working in energy is how many people really are expert in energy and how much consensus there is, actually. There are parts around the edge of the debate where we disagree, but those people who work in the sector largely agree on some of the building blocks. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I do and what government does in this space, and then I've got a short list of things we definitely know and things which are a bit more uncertain, because there's a lot of uncertainty in transition. So my job is I'm lead analyst for power in the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero. I've got a relatively small team of my own, and then I work across lots of other teams to make sure that we have a consistent whole evidence base. What we're there for is to make sure that ministers have the right evidence to be able to take decisions, and that's professional evidence, that is independent evidence. We abide by, I don't know if you've come across the Treasury Green Book and the Magenta Book and all of the colour books, which describe how government analysts do things in a way which means that citizens of this country know that the evidence is as good as it can be and is high quality. Written down on here, we do it on behalf of the public, and that's something that's really important to me. I've been a public servant for 30 years. I've worked in different departments. I've been head of profession for operational research in 3 different departments. I don't do this because there's a particular government view that I'd like to press. I do this because actually I want our citizens to be served. You've all voted for a government. I will serve that government, and I will make sure that they get the best advice they possibly can to make the decisions that you have voted them in for. So I've wrote down a few things about what does this look like? What does it actually mean when I say we're providing evidence? So I'm responsible for example, has anyone come across REMA? A couple of snorts, yeah. So the analysis that fed into the decision last year about whether we move to zonal pricing or not and how we reform our markets. We've also got security of supply. So how much... So we support NESO's, the National Energy System Operator, who operate the system on our behalf, run something called the capacity market. So each year they'll assess how much capacity we have on the system against kind of various resilience scenarios, and we will be advising ministers on how much to procure in those auctions. So it's just a couple of examples of the kind of things we do. We advise on investment, so where government should intervene and where we should leave it to markets and citizens, because as you will be aware, government shouldn't intervene in everything. Government should wait until there is a market failure or a big gap, because there needs to be room for industry, for private enterprise and for citizens to take action and deliver what they would need. So, right, what do we know? Got my list here. First one, there's broad consensus that climate change is happening. It feels wrong that I need to keep saying this, but anyone who's picked up a paper recently will see that there's a growing public discourse in the opposite direction, and I find it quite phenomenal, actually, given how there is broad international consensus now. It's not just scientists, it's international and governmental consensus, but just keep that in your mind, because it comes down to a point I'm going to make at the end about one of the things that we can all do here and should be doing. And similarly, a point that you made, Spencer, electrification of economies is becoming thought of as the main kind of way to decarbonise. So it's broadly accepted now, and the IEA report that you mentioned just reported how many countries now are heading down this path of electrification as the route, one of the core routes to decarbonisation. There's some things we can't get at, like aviation to some extent, and shipping, for example, but broadly there's a huge amount that you can do on decarbonisation just through electrification, and that's internationally recognised. Another thing that the two of you have both mentioned is challenging economics and geopolitics. We're living in a really quite unsettled world at the moment, and that brings the kind of energy security points that you were making, Spencer, to sharp relief. But it also means that the cost is on people's minds. It's an incredibly challenging time to be making some of these decisions, and people up and down the country are struggling to get through each week. So we do have to make sure that every penny that we spend is a penny well spent. Right, let's get on to the meat of it now. So not a competition is the next thing I've written. I don't believe it is a competition between cost and decarbonisation. I think there's an awful lot that is common between the pathways that we would choose, whether we were decarbonising or not. For the UK in particular, we have ageing infrastructure. We haven't invested very much for 20-30 years. We have a nuclear AGR fleet, which is reaching the end of its life. We have a gas fleet, kind of 20 gigawatts or so of gas, which is reaching the end of its life. That needs to be replaced by something. We published a paper, it was in 2020, so it's some time ago now, which showed that we did simulation modelling thousands of different scenarios, and we showed that it's actually just as cheap to refresh that infrastructure using decarbonised production as it would be to do it in a way that used fossil fuels. So there's a growing body of evidence, that's one part, but there's lots of other people who've since replicated and done similar analysis to show that actually the core component of what you do with an electric system would be the same as you replace and enlarge. It's not a competition. There definitely are some quite difficult choices when you're getting to, you know, the last 10% of emissions. Those things probably are quite costly, but the core of what you do, a renewables-based system with storage, with flexibility, I won't get into nuclear in this forum, I think nuclear has a place in the mix, but a mixed system is actually one of the most cost-effective things to do, whether you want to decarbonise or not. The last thing on my list is that it's complex, and that really doesn't play into the current politics. So the public narrative, media narrative, social media is soundbites, quick things. These are really complex issues. They're very difficult to understand, and they don't make very good soundbites. So trying to extract the soundbites and the things which will help bring the public along from the complex mass of interacting kind of things within the system, all of the different actors across the whole of the economy. This is something that affects every single one of us here. It's really, really hard. So that's something that I think is definitely true, that it's complex, that we need to understand that it's complex, and we need to understand the challenges and try and think about how we engage the public in this, which Octopus is actually doing incredibly well at. So what don't we know? I think we're just at the foothills of a transition which is of the scale of the Industrial Revolution, certainly of the scale of these things. Who would have said 25 years ago, as I brought my first one of these, that we would all be walking around and doing what we do with phones in the way that we are now, and that data would be so prolific and available. I would love a world where electricity is prolific, available and cheap, to be able to power future economies, to be able to power all of the AI we want to. But the transition is only just starting now. So the 2030 targets that we've got to decarbonise the system, that's just replacing the current fleet and decarbonising with about the same demand. But the kind of levels of increased demand that we're talking about, if we do decarbonise heat, and transport, surface transport, for example. That's a twofold increase in demand and a fourfold increase in infrastructure to service that demand over the following kind of 10 to 15 years after that. It's massive. And there are some really kind of systemic things that we need to do to make that happen. What else don't we know? Don't know exactly when the inflection points will happen. We've seen with the current commodity price crisis, for example, people are choosing to buy EVs, and that happened the last time. And it's the economics, it's the demand and supply thing. People feel challenged by the spikes. They don't want to be exposed to that risk, and those who've got the money will insure themselves against that. But we don't know exactly when we'll tip from a gradual increase in purchases to the full take-up, as we did. If you tried to say in 1999, when I got my first one of these, when would everyone be walking around with these in your pocket, you'd get it wrong. But that's where we are in our transition now. It's actually quite difficult to tell when those inflection points happen, which brings risk. We don't know where all the opportunities are. We're only just starting to scratch the surface of what AI can do for us as a society. Huge number of different technologies out there globally. People are looking at stuff all around the world, and we don't understand all of that yet. Got two more points. I think I'm running out of time, aren't I? We don't know exactly how the system will work. NESO, I should reassure, so National Energy System Operator is spending an awful lot of time working out how a system like this will work. There is nowhere in the world yet. So I think Spain is probably close, but operating on a highly renewables basis. So we think we know how it's going to work. We're learning internationally all the time. But we don't know exactly how it's going to work. How do you replace your big spinning turbines to keep the frequency at the right level, using different kinds of storage? There's lots of work going on that at the moment, but it is a big thing. The last one on my list, it is going back to the points that the two of you are making, is how can we all take part? So mobile phone usage has happened through citizens' choice, through people's choice. This is a different kind of transition. And it's something that is on my mind, actually. This won't happen unless there is public support. Media seems quite split at the moment. The public seem quite split. Political parties seem quite split. So if there's one thing I would leave you with, I don't think economics on its own is going to drive this change. But if you are able to, if you've got ideas for how you think citizens can be engaged in a complex system transition that could ultimately be something which halts the rise of climate change, I'd love to know about it, as I'm sure would everyone else. So thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Teresa. It's really striking to hear about how much analytical work goes into sort of navigating all of the uncertainty there is in the energy landscape today, and how you shape policy and government. We'll hear next from Min Cha. Min, over to you.
Thank you, Shefali. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining our panel. It's an honor to be with like this amazing speakers and chair here this evening. I think we've talked a lot of the important topics about the energy system these days, about the electrification, energy security, data centers, and so on. And today, I'd like to build on Tim Santeros's point about how to make sure about like how make sure that citizens and consumers to be part of the transition. I want to look into the demand side, extending their points. So as Shefali briefly introduced, my research is primarily on the renewable energy policies and the adoption of clean technologies like solar, electric vehicles, heat pumps, and so on. And what I consistently find while reading the papers in this area or doing my own research is that like while the adoption of these clean technologies is really important for decarbonization, but like the pace at which it happens, who drives it, and who's benefiting it, like all of these remain fascinating and underdeveloped questions. So take the example of what's driving the adoption of these technologies. Like we often think it's the economics. If the price is right, then people are gonna take it or buy these technologies. But in reality, it's more complicated than that. Like other factors, like attitudes, like risk averse, or whether you're interested in environmental issues or not, and other socioeconomic factors like your friends, neighbors, and social norms all together affect your decision to adopt these clean technologies. And often, like, I also find that like these factors are interacting with each other. So for instance, your knowledge on this technology interact with your individual belief, which all together affect your perception of these technologies, your support, and eventually whether you adopt it or not. And once they adopt these technologies, the story doesn't end there. And then like they also change their consumption behavior after the adoption. So for instance, like the electric vehicle cars, I think Spencer mentioned it briefly, but like they tend to drive more kilometers after they switch to the electric cars because the cost of driving is less than the petrol car. So this can undermine the expected benefits of switching to electric car by like expected benefits of the carbon carbon reduction, right? Which we call the rebound effect in the literature. And my own research, I also find that like looking into solar electricity, people change their consumption patterns after adopting solar electricity. So for instance, like some of the adopters, after receiving it, like they increase their electricity consumption during the summertime because like we see more solar radiation out there and we expect more electricity generated from the panels. So all of these kind of like demand side responses and dynamics are really difficult to predict, and it's putting a real challenges in terms of the grid planning and demand forecasting, adding difficulty in terms of our question about grid reliability, sustainability, and energy affordability. And I think one of the important points, I think Tim mentioned about it, how like the putting cost, like thinking of the cost of this like transition, right? So like there's a question of who's benefiting from this like transitioning or adopting these renewable energy sources and who's paying for it. So from consumers' perspective, many studies found that like the adoption is often skewed toward often the wealthier households or the specific socio-demographic groups in our society. And this raises an equity concern, right? So when only a subset of the people can enjoy it, the cost of running and maintaining the grid and other stuff can fall disproportionately to the people who haven't adopted it or who cannot afford to it. So, I mean, altogether, I think it's really, like, thinking of the grid reliability, energy affordability, sustainability, altogether, like, it's really important to think about the broader spec and then the supply side. But I think it's not just about that. Like, it's not just about adding more green energy capacity to our grid. I think we also need to think about, as like echoing other speakers, like we also need to think about and understand the demand side dynamics and responses and how to make sure that like all of us, like consumers, can also engage in these questions and transition.
Thanks very much, Min, and thank you to all four of our speakers. We've already heard a rich set of perspectives from industry, government, and academia. We're running a little bit behind schedule, and so I did want to ask one question. Maybe I'll pose it to the panel, but we'll also collect a few questions from the audience here in the room as well as online. So please start thinking about the questions that you would like to pose to the panel. I'd like to sort of return to the question that we started the session with, which is around the energy trilemma, right? How do we ensure energy remains clean, reliable, and affordable? And the question is, are these genuinely compatible goals? Is it just a matter of fixing market design, for example? Or are they somehow in conflict with one another and we're just having to make trade-offs as a result? So just to provide some context from the UK, you know, in 2025, wind power was estimated to have lowered UK electricity prices by nearly a third compared to what it would have been without this technology. However, household bills still rose by £169 in real terms since 2021, and that's largely driven by the increase in wholesale gas prices and not green levies, as is often assumed. Now, part of the reason is structural. The wholesale price is set by the last most expensive generator dispatched. So even if there is a lot of cheap wind energy available, consumers don't necessarily see it in the in sort of the, you know, on their energy bills. Also, there's work from the Climate Change Committee, which shows that the total net additional cost of meeting net zero by 2050 in the UK is likely no greater than the total additional cost of a single future energy crisis, of the scale of what we saw in 2022 following the Russian invasion in Ukraine. So the evidence seems to suggest that clean energy and affordable energy may in fact be more compatible than people think. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. And we'll also start taking some questions from the audience in the meantime. So please raise your hand if you have a question for the panel. So we'll take about three questions. You in the green shirt. Sorry, the grey shirt.
Hi, my name's Luigi, and I'm a bachelor's of management student at LSC. My question generally to the panel is more maybe related to, I think there's a lot of mention about the fact that a lot of the growth of electrification is in developing markets. And I think a common theme with their kind of progress is that they'll be more decentralized behind the meter community solar projects. But in terms of, I was kind of wondering, you know, how does that affect the general energy markets that they have? Maybe it's underdeveloped, but kind of managing, you know, supply will be a lot more complex. And so, like, how does that kind of work? And also, does that also apply to developed markets as well, in case, you know, the technology is quite sufficient?
Great. The lady in the black and white shirt.
Thank you so much for the talk. I was really curious on your opinions on how we can best mobilize AI for a secure demand-side transition.
The man in the white shirt in the first row.
Yeah, thank you for an interesting talk. My name is Jurek, I'm from Technical University of Berlin, and I would like to ask, what's your solution, or what do you think is the, or is there the solution in terms of flexibility of the energy system? Is it BESS, is just building a lot of it, or are there different approaches as well, which are quite relevant?
I think we'll now take one or two questions from the online audience. Isabel, would you like to relay those to us?
I always like it when you have lots of questions because it means the really hard ones you could forget about.
Pick the ones you like. Yeah.
So we have a question from an LSE alumnus, Vijay, and they have asked, why should we transition to energy systems like solar and wind that depend on intensive mineral extraction, given the environmental and social harms linked to mining in some parts of the world? And then we have a second question, which is from an anonymous user, and they said similar. So why don't we harness tidal and other hydropower more in the UK? Why wind and solar?
All right. I'll leave it to the panel to pick the questions that you like to answer. Is there anyone who'd like to go first?
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
I'll pick up the one on decentralisation in mature systems, because that's a topic that's quite close to my heart. And I'm going to be a bit of a broken record on this, which is the cost point again. Your observation that actually it's not just economics that drives what consumers do is something that we sort of live every single day. In fact, the one thing the psychology of marketing shows you is that people always do sort of unexpected stuff because we're driven as human beings, not as kind of logic machines, but by a bunch of other different kind of factors. But I do think it plays a really fundamental role in as a sort of base to what's happening. And the issue we have, I think, with electricity costs in particular is it doesn't just depress demand, but we lose political and voter support, and that obviously undermines the whole kind of project here, which makes politicians get nervous. It gets, you know, people start reversing policy. You may have seen in the news the government sort of making, there was some speculation about changes to the ZEV mandate. So we're seeing a lot of this kind of fractious back and forth at the moment because there's so much noise around cost, I think, to Theresa's point. But there's this concept in energy systems called the utility death spiral. And the idea is that you're recovering the cost of infrastructure over sort of units of demand. And if that goes down, you can not recover as much because you've got fewer people paying for something. And those people need to pay more in order to keep the thing going, and it goes up and becomes a death spiral. And you know, to some respect, this is kind of what we're seeing a little bit in the water sector, but I think we're going to start to see it in the electricity sector as well if we don't do something about it. And so your question, which is what about kind of mature markets, is if it is cheaper for people to generate electricity themselves, whether it's people or it's kind of businesses, or to do it in a way that engages less with the system, that is what they will do. Because we're all, you know, have those kind of economic needs. And that, I think, is the great risk that we have to manage in the transition, that we actually keep investing in the system, because the system provides redundancy, it provides, you know, returns to scale for economic benefits, unlocks optionality, in fact, actually, is what the energy system gives us. But if it becomes too expensive, people will stop using it. I think decentralization of our energy systems is good. To Spencer's point, I think it increases resilience. But it is a harder and more complex system to operate. We need to change the rules, basically. It's a harder thing to do. And there will be impacts, economic impacts, on the rest of the country. And not everyone can afford to do it as well. So we have to look after everyone in this. It can't just be for sort of people who can afford it as well. So I think it's a unstoppable trend, and one that we need to be very kind of proactive about.
Why don't you guys go and I'll pick up what's left.
Right, I'll have a go. There were two in there I was thinking of. One is on the trilemma question, which I think is fascinating. I said something in my intro about how I don't think there is as much tension as the word trilemma kind of gets across. So trilemma makes it feel like they are definitely in tension, and it's one or the other. I don't think there is. I think there's a core to the energy system which actually is kind of lowest cost, decarbonised and secure. I think there are choices around that, and there's a lot of uncertainty around those choices and the costs and the risks that we bear. The one thing I'd bring out in terms of bills is that, and I think it goes to your point actually, that the speed of fifth feed through will be different in the future system than now. So we're going from a system where it's relatively cheap to throw up a fossil fuel burning plant, and then what you're exposed to is then the cost of the commodity that you're burning. So sometimes it's cheap and sometimes it's expensive, and we've had a couple of expensive periods recently, and that brings into sharp kind of focus what the risks of a kind of low build, higher, kind of more variable operating cost system looks like in the future. What we're moving towards is a system where your investment cost up front is higher, but actually your marginal operating cost is much lower. And that, the point that we're at the moment, we're making lots of investment and we need to wait for that to work through. So we pay off the investment and then it gets really, really cheap when we've got a system with really short run marginal costs, which are very low. We're at a difficult point in the transition. So I think timing is the thing. In terms of bills, something like a third of bills is network costs and kind of other things. I think it's about 25% wholesale costs at the moment. You're right about the dynamic where as we deploy more renewables, the wholesale part of the bill will go down. We'll get more fixed costs on the bill and lower variable costs. So it will protect bill payers to some extent from the volatility that we've seen recently. So if you believe that we're in an increasingly volatile world and these kind of shocks will happen more often than they have in the past, a fixed cost system is better. If you believe that we should remain exposed to those and reap the benefits of having cheap plant that you can throw up and hope or have economic models which deliver that at kind of cheap prices, then you might choose otherwise. I think we're actually in a more volatile world than we have been, and I would actually think that we are going to see more volatility in future, and that citizens and consumers are valuing some kind of stability in a way that they haven't in previous generations. But that is a call for politicians to make. That is a genuine call about which kind of system you want. On the why not hydro question. We do want hydro. We definitely want hydro. We want all kinds of different technologies. I think the sheer scale of the concrete involved in a hydro plant means that we wouldn't want them across the whole country, I'm sure. But we are. I mean, there are hydro plants, I believe, kind of bidding into flex markets and new plants being considered at the moment. So that, I don't think there's a blanket no on other things. It's just that actually wind and solar are really, really cheap, partially supported by China making such a big investment in turning a nascent technology into something which can be churned out very quickly. So they are quite cheap at the moment relative to the cost of those other things. But a system doesn't just run on renewables. The system needs flexible technologies. It needs kind of consistent technologies. It needs all of the technologies. So I don't think we're saying no hydro, no nuclear, no this, no that. It's what the balance of those technologies is within a system. That's important.
Okay, I want to touch on the question of the first question from the chair. Just brief, I want to echo Therese's points about it. I think they are not like conflicting each other, and then they are not like there is not much tension among three of the components. As Shefali pointed out, there are many like green signals. I think in terms of the renewable energy deployment. Of course, there are some questions and the problems remain, like mostly about the intermittency issue of the renewables, but I think there are some technological development in the energy storage system and so on. So I think in the long term, it's not like it's achievable. But again, as Theresa pointed out, there are many uncertainty going on. And I think eventually we need to think about how like our current market and system is suitable for those changes. Like because like current market and system is like built upon like traditional centralized energy system with like really big fossil fuel power plants and transmission lines accordingly, but like as we are seeing more and more dispersed system and so on, I think we need to think about like reform the markets eventually. And I want to touch upon the question about demobilizing AI to this transition. I think like whenever I think about the AI and energy, it's like super fascinating because like because of the AI usage, it's driving, it's affecting our demand, right? Like so far, like thanks to the energy efficient technologies, like we haven't seen like much demand surge so far because of the data center. But we are going to see more and more hyperscale data center, which is like in like a bigger and more power dense building. So we will experience the demand increase because of the data centers. But at the same time, I think we can use this AI technology for, to accelerate our effort to transition. For instance, I think I saw some paper about it. I think it was Octopus Energy. Like you are trying to like, use the AI to build an algorithm for the electric vehicles, like to charge and discharge to maximize the benefits for the customers. I think it's one example. And not just about the transition, considering that like the demand side management, like there are many papers about how automation versus like you just like changing your putting off and off, on and off the lights and thermometers change the electricity consumption. Often people find that like because of the complexity of the electricity bills, like automation using like digital techniques and AI, it's better for consumers to benefit using this AI in their consumption behavior. And this is not about the demand side, but I also want to put that like in terms of the data center, like there are some questions of whether it's driving, it's putting more carbon up in the air or not. So like I think it's in the US at least, like many data centers so far have backup generators running from diesel or natural gas, which is obviously not good for our environment. But like there are also some companies like Microsoft or Meta who's like building the renewable energy behind the meters along with their data center construction. So I think like if we have some some efforts from the government and like some public to make sure that like they are also interested in the renewable energy deployment along with their data centers, I think it will help our strategy for the transition.
Let me try and pick up on the two questions that haven't been answered. Just for the record, I think the energy trilemma is a big deal, and I think there is a conflict. And it's always great to have an argument across the panel, but we won't answer the two questions. But I'm more than happy to bore for England for why I think the trilemma is a relevant thing, concept. So you asked about flexibility or sort of a secret sauce for the energy system. I'm not sure I got a good answer on flexibility. But one thing I just want to put in the room, and I'm going to use you as an excuse to put it in the room. When we're thinking about the energy transition, we think a lot about electrification. We think a lot about the clean energy to drive that electrification. We have to think equally hard about energy efficiency, because it's sort of simple when you think about it. The only way we decarbonize, if we produce enough clean energy, which more than meets the growth of overall energy demand, so I can take some of the fossil which was being used and I don't need to use it anymore. So one bit is I need to build out lots of clean, and electrification is part of the way of harnessing that. The other bit, I've got to reduce the amount by which my overall energy demand rises. And if I do that, I've got a better chance of getting to a point where I'm starting to decarbonize the world. So I don't think that's your answer to your question, but it's a sort of secret sauce I worry about. And then I just want to go back to the question online, because I always think it's so hard to view things online. So we should try and answer the question. I don't know enough about the question was raised about, well, hold on, but if you're going to start switching to electrification and that's going to have a whole set of issues to do with mining, and that mining is going to lead to environmental issues, you've got to think about that. So I start from the basis that my favourite law in economics is Stein's law. So Stein was Herbert Stein, who was the Jimmy Carter's chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors. And Stein's law, if something can't go on forever, it will stop. Now, one level you think, that's why you're an economist. You can get a law named after you saying something as simple as, if something can't go on forever, it will stop. And so one level but another level is profound. We can't carry on using fossil fuels. They've got to stop. And so the only issue now is how quickly and in what way. And so the answer to this question is, we've got to move away from fossil. And the best we've got at the moment is the various forms of electrification. It may be that we get some huge breakthrough, but I don't think we can't wait for that breakthrough. And so I think the challenge to the mining, the question is, we've got to just think about doing very responsible mining. And I think you can do that in such a way that net-net, we should be beneficial. But I don't think we can just wait for science to solve our problem, because the nature of the way we're using up the carbon budget is we haven't got that time. And so we need to do this as quickly as possible, and we've got to invoke Stein's law that we've got to get to this point where we stop using carbon.
Coming very quickly on energy efficiency, just so that the thing, I agree with you actually, so we'll have an argument in the green room about the trilemma later, but on energy efficiency, the thing that costs money in the electricity system is the peaks. It's the difference between the low periods and the high periods. And in a world where we decarbonise heat, because we're quite a cold island in the winter, those winter peaks are going to be the thing that really do put pressure on the system. So I do agree with you. Energy efficiency, particularly that which will help to shift or reduce those peaks, will result in a much lower cost system overall.
And maybe I can just add on to that point as well, the kind of two previous points around flexibility, because this is a topic that we kind of do a lot in. One of the kind of challenges we have at the moment is, and this is all over the world, it's certainly not just the UK, is we're thinking about a world where we're going to have a lot more electricity on the system, and therefore we need more grids to carry it. But as Teresa said before, it's really difficult to predict what that is actually going to look like. And also we've got a complex system as well, right? So it's not one big machine that we can design. It's actually a whole set of things. It's, you know, markets and contracts and sort of, you know, locked in stuff for 20 years and, you know, stuff that goes down to the sort of very second. So we've got this big complex set of stuff and a bunch, by the way, of laws as well, which we can't just kind of ignore. We have previous commitments that we need to deliver on. It's been really interesting to watch the debate over the last kind of few years, because we've gone from probably, you know, it's happened so quickly. Just a couple of years ago, everyone was going, oh my God, AI, fantastic. If I'm in the energy space, I can, you know, loads of stuff to invest in the energy systems. There's going to be so much kind of energy demand. We're all going to make a load of money. And then it's gone, oh my God, no, the energy price, the consumer bill. And that's happening multiple markets, maybe more sort of, you know, you see it in kind of developed markets than you do in sort of emerging economies, but it's a kind of global phenomenon. And we've been talking about spending €1 trillion euros to build out grids in Europe, and now the Commission is kind of going, actually, maybe, you know, that might not be the best thing for us to do. Maybe there are more efficient ways of doing it. And that's where flexibility comes in, because we understandably build our systems with a margin of error, so that if, for whatever reason, we have more electricity flowing through them, the lights don't go out. We know, our own data shows us, that if we add an EV driver to a household, their total electricity consumption goes up by about 60%. But the increase at the peak period, which is between 4 and 7 p.m., goes up by about 6%. And that's because we now, EV charging is very well managed generally, at kind of, or, you know, increasingly well managed at the residential level. We push that electricity usage outside of the peak period. So we have more units of electricity going over the system. That's great, because we recover more cost. But we're not pushing the peak up to the same extent, which means we don't need to build as much grid. And then if you think about a world of V2G, vehicle to grid or vehicle to home, we can do the opposite. We can actually pull that demand down at that peak period as well. So we can get more volume without putting the infrastructure in. So this is a different version of Spencer's efficiency question, which is, it's the efficiency of the system as opposed to the efficiency of the use. We need to carry more volume of electricity across our existing system than we do today. And that is the magic unlock. That is the thing that actually delivers the kind of economic growth that electricity usage provides, while controlling the spend, which isn't to say we shouldn't build new stuff. We absolutely should. Your point around, you know, we've got bits of it that are falling over and need replacing and kind of 20 years old and all the rest of it. We should work really, really hard not building stuff we don't need to build. And that, I think, is where flexibility comes in. And we need to use all sources of flexibility. So, yes, grid-scale batteries, yes, you know, home batteries, moving demand around, putting stuff back into the system, you know, molecules as well as electrons, the whole lot. We need to use it all.
Great. Thank you so much to our speakers for a fascinating discussion, which I hope all of you enjoyed. What I take away from this conversation is that the challenge isn't just about building energy infrastructure. It's also about building the rules, the incentives, the trust and engagement to make, you know, the system work for everyone. As Teresa mentioned, we're living through a complete overhaul of the energy system globally, one that will reshape how we heat our homes, power our businesses, even how we relate to each other as consumers and citizens. What strikes me the most is, you know, we already know what needs to be built. The harder work is institutional, political, social, and I think that's precisely where universities like LSE have a role to play, not just in producing research, but also in convening conversations like this one across sectors. So I'm very grateful to Tim, Spencer, Teresa, and Min for bringing that spirit tonight. Please join me in thanking them one more time.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.